you. Good morning, everyone. So in 2003, Ron Stahl published a paper that really tried to argue this notion of syndemics as being very critical to considering HIV infection, particularly among men who have sex with men. And the argument was that it's not one thing that sort of leads gay men to engage in risky sex or seroconvert, but it's an additive effect of multiple syndemic conditions that gay men often face, and that they face at rates that are often higher than the other population. And Ron looked at four specific variables in doing this. He looked at childhood sexual abuse, partner violence, depression, and polydrug use. And what he found was that as the number of syndemic conditions increased, so did the likelihood of recent high-risk sex and the rate of HIV prevalence. So that by the time you get to three or four of these conditions affecting the same individual, you have very high rates of risky sex and seroconversion. So while Ron was doing this work, we had been doing a lot of work on the notion of sexual compulsivity as a mental health variable related to sexual risk. And we look at it, there's a lot of different ways that this has been described. We tend to characterize sexual compulsivity as things like the recurrent failure to resist sexual impulses, persistent desire, unsuccessful attempts to stop or control sexual behavior, an inordinate amount of time spent obtaining sex, being sexual, recovering from sex, preoccupation, and some sort of a tolerance or a need for more as time goes by. And so in 2012, we conducted a study where we basically added sexual compulsivity as a syndemic condition. We felt that, like depression, it was a mental health variable that could be driving HIV risk and sexual behavior and sort of being the same type of thing in terms of having an additive effect if you added that on to some of these other problems and concerns. And we got very comparable results when we added it. So we sort of came up with a five condition notion of syndemics, adding upon Ron's work. It's important to figure out what we're talking about because a lot of different terms have been used to explain this kind of phenomenon. Certainly, it started with nymphomania, which is a real charming one. That's one that you want to use a lot. Then either sexual compulsivity or compulsive sexual behavior. People have tied it to impulsivity. The term sex addiction, especially if you're Tiger Woods or a movie star who's caught cheating on their wife, that's the term that they use because that implies you need just, you know, a little 12-step program and you'll be fine. Sexual dependency, and then most recently this term hypersexual disorder. Came out. That was proposed for inclusion as consideration of a disorder in the DSM-5, and then at the last minute it was dropped and removed for the lack of enough empirical data to support it as a unique mental health diagnosis. So we're sort of in this weird limbo that we clearly have a phenomenon going on, but we don't have a technical diagnosis for it yet. So we try to work around that. So there are measures, though, for this construct. The most commonly used one is the SCS, or the Sexual Compulsivity Scale, that Seth Kallisman and his colleagues developed. There's also now a measure for hypersexual disorder, the Hypersexual Disorder Screening Inventory, which was the measure that was going to be associated with the diagnosis in the DSM. And both of them measure similar sexually related problems. We've looked at this in some of our earlier work. The continuous scores are strongly correlated. Both of them are reliable measures, and they've been validated across a number of populations. We really started to entertain this idea of we're not just dealing with an either-or. It may not be just you either are or you're not. That, in fact, we might be dealing with some sort of underlying groups. And so one of the things that we did in this paper that came out in the Journal of Sexual Medicine was taking the two measures to combine them to come up with sort of a better way of looking at this. And we actually, from that, came up with three different groups. What we would call fine, no sexual compulsivity or hypersexual disorder, people who meet criteria for sexual compulsivity but not hypersexual disorder, and then people who meet criteria for both. And so I'm going to talk more about that. We look at data from a study called Pillow Talk, and this is the amazing group of folks who have been working on that project for the last 4 or 5 years. One of the things we consider in this study is how many male sex partners does a gay man need to be classified as highly sexually active. We were very concerned that a lot of the research on sexual compulsivity would compare men who had a lot of partners to men who had one partner, and guess what? You'd find differences. Okay, so let's get a whole group of men who are having a lot of sex and then see if we see some of those same differences. So we decided that it takes 9 partners to be highly sexually active. We came at that because it was triple the average from the New York City sample of the Urban Men's Health Study, which was a probability-based sample of MSM, and it was more than double the average among men that we were routinely surveying in our annual community surveys. So we felt that that was a good kind of marker. People said, oh my God, you will never get, 300 to 400 men who have sex with men who have had 9 or more partners in the last 90 days. Right. So we went to try to recruit them. And we did this with very sex-positive messaging. We were very pleased when we were able to get BallSack approved by our IRB in one of our apps. Right there, I thought, let's push the envelope. My partner who does our graphic stuff, he's like, let me blur it out. I'm like, no, let's just see if they... Yeah. We have to do things to keep ourselves entertained. We did not want to come at this from a shame perspective. We thought, we're going to be following these men for a year. It's very important that they know that we are not in any way pathologizing them for the amount of sex that they're having, that it's a very sort of sex-positive approach to conducting research. We started using respondent-driven sampling. That was a huge failure. The men themselves were really interested and excited to be involved in the project, but they just couldn't really convince their friends to do it. So we also tried some field recruitment that met with some levels of success, but what really worked for us was internet recruitment, using sites like Grindr, using sex party listservs, Facebook, Adam for Adam. Those efforts were much more successful. So to be eligible, you had to identify as gay, bisexual, or a non-heterosexual identity. We didn't want heterosexually identified men who have sex with men kind of clouding the data, because often they can be perceiving that their sex behavior is out of control and sort of sexually compulsive just by the fact that they're heterosexual and having sex with men. So we wanted to kind of get them out. They had to have the 9 or more partners, internet access at home because of some of the daily diary aspects of the study, proof of either HIV positive status or willing to have a rapid test at our office. So we got 377 men. Two of them didn't complete the at-home survey, and 4 had some inconsistent data, so we ended up with 370 that are going to be in this analysis. This is the demographics of the sample. The average age was 36. The range was 18 to 73. God bless that 73-year-old, right? I'm like, God bless you, you give me hope. About half of the sample were men of color. It was a split of about 56% HIV negative. Again, that's documented HIV negative, and the rest were positive. And then we had some diversity around education and income, and 80% of the men were single. Now, keep in mind, the 20% who were partnered were still having 9 or more partners in the last 90 days. So despite not stratifying in any way, we ended up with about half of our sample who we would describe as neither sexually compulsive nor hypersexual, 21% who were both, and 30% who just met criteria on the Kalachman scale for sexual compulsivity. And so the first, I think, take-home point is you can be a gay man and be having a lot of sex partners and a lot of sex, and end up on this, 49% of the sample where you're not really suffering from any kind of mental health issues related to that. So that's a good sign. We looked at sexual behavior comparisons, and we didn't find any significant differences with regard to things like the number of male partners, the number of anal sex acts, or the number of acts with serodiscordant partners. Where we start to see differences are when we get to the risky sex acts. And that's where we do see that the... Oh, I didn't mean to click that yet. There we go. The men who are in the both SC and HD groups having significantly more condomless anal sex acts and condomless anal sex acts with serodiscordant partners. So the amount of sex, no difference. The amount of risky sex, the amount of sex that's likely to transmit HIV, that's where we see the difference. Then we look at the syndemic factors and compare them on the 3 groups. We see that for intimate partner violence, you definitely see a pattern going, a significant pattern of more likelihood of that as you move from neither too sexually compulsive to sexually compulsive and hypersexual. For childhood sexual abuse, the difference was only for those in the both group. And for depression, it was the difference was between those who had neither and then either of the other two groups. For polydrug use, we had no difference. This is based on the average number of syndemic conditions, and what we see here is a pattern where it does increase as you move across the three different categorizations that we had. So all three of those groups are significantly different. Okay, so we wanted to see how does this kind of categorization of sexually compulsive or hypersexual, how might it mediate with syndemics and HIV risk? So we started looking at a PATH model looking at both direct and indirect effects. And we did treat syndemics and the three groups as ordinal variables in this. So the first PATH, all the way to the left, shows that for every syndemic factor that a man experienced, his odds of moving up into a more severe SCHD group was 1.4. So it went up. Then the middle PATH showed the direct effects of syndemics and the three groups. And what we see here is moving up one level of severity in the SCHD group was associated with a 16% increase in the odds of reporting UAI with steroid-discordant partners. And the number of syndemic factors was associated with a 19% increase in that. Then if you go back to the groups, moving up one severity level there was associated with a 25% increase in the odds of being HIV positive. And the number of syndemic factors was associated with a 27% increase. And then, obviously, both UAIX with steroid-discordant partners and positive status were associated with each other, as is typically found in these kinds of studies. So then we wanted to look at the indirect effects from syndemic factors to unprotected anal intercourse through our group comparisons of the SCHD groups. And what we found was a marginally significant mediation, suggesting that the effect of syndemics on UAI is weakly mediated by the SC or HD group. And then when we did it with HIV positive status, we had significant mediation. So suggesting that there is a significant but still only partial mediation of syndemics on HIV status through the SCHD group. And that indirect effect accounted for 24% of the total effect of syndemics on HIV positive status. So we wanted to model what adding the two different versions of looking at this phenomenon, just SC versus not, versus our three groups, would have on the syndemic factor. And so this shows that considering sexual compulsivity alone as a syndemic factor, just whether they met criteria on the Kalachman or not, strengthens the association between syndemic factors and HIV risk outcomes for both steroid-discordant condomless anal sex and positive status. But when we take the three-group version, focus on the red beta weights, which are much higher in this model, suggesting that it's still a better way to conceptualize things. Really looking at these men across these three groups rather than two seems to have some benefit analytically. So, sexual compulsivity and hypersexual disorder are strongly related to syndemics, and this sort of documents some further utility in splitting the groups three ways instead of just two. All of the three groups differed in the proportion of who had experienced interpersonal partner violence in the prior 5 years. The both group had significantly higher rates of childhood sexual abuse, and the neither group had significantly fewer men who had experienced depression, so going back to the basics of syndemics. No association with substance use, though, in this sample. And all three groups were significantly different in the total number of syndemic factors experienced. We had some partial evidence of that the severity of sexual compulsivity or hypersexual disorder mediates the association between syndemics and these HIV risk outcomes, but much of the association was a direct effect. And adding the three groups' way of classifying this to the syndemics variable did improve the strength of the association with the HIV outcomes. So again, we sort of think that looking at this as a three-group process, and it may very well be that the group who meets criteria for sexual compulsivity but not hypersexual disorder could be in transition. They could be sort of at risk of eventually developing hypersexual disorder. They might be kind of on the cusp, we don't really know. We need some more longitudinal work to look at that. Some of our follow-up data that we're doing in this study will give us some sense of that. And I want to acknowledge everybody who was involved with this project. It's been a long endeavor on our part. And if you have questions, thank you.